You're listening to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin. And in every episode, he features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Over the past few weeks, you've heard encore presentations of some of our favorite episodes so far this year. And today, as we prepare to move forward into Season 14, we're looking back on some of the highlights of our guest interviews from 2022. We'll start with Steve's interview with David Thornwill, a conversation from February of this year. David is Group CISO for shipping and logistics giant DHL. As you can imagine, making cultural changes to bolster security at a multinational corporation with more than 500,000 employees isn't easy. But David had some advice that CISOs at an organization of any size can take to heart.
And many organizations tell me that they struggle to get business leadership involved in these sorts of things, really to justify participating. How have you managed to do that at DHL?
Persistence. You know, I would have made exactly the same comment probably 3 years ago, you know, where we would run a simulation and perhaps people who came along were 2-3 levels down from the board level, sort of sent as delegates to take care of that simulation thing for me.
Right.
But of course, as you know, in a real life situation, it's going to be the top executives that are involved in the incident, in the remediation, in addressing the topic and recovering. And so you need them there in the, if you will, simulations, the rehearsals as well. And over time, we, you know, as I say, the mask and TNT thing brought it home. But as we've rehearsed more and more, as our CEO, our board members have emphasized that to their reports as well, we've, if you will, climbed up the hierarchy step by step.
So how long do you think that's taken? About 3 years, I think you said?
Yes.
So anybody listening to this who aspires to have that similar kind of participation should really be preparing themselves for the long run. It's not going to be something that you can accomplish overnight.
Quite. I mean, I don't know whether I would say it's 3 years or whatever, but tenacity, just sticking at it, you know, maintaining the messaging, bringing in examples, which are increasing, of course, from competitors and others who are involved or who suffer such an attack, can only help. You know, you've just got to keep at it, I think. There's no magic solution to this.
Next, we'll hear from a guest who focuses on security for companies on the other end of the spectrum from DHL, small to medium-sized businesses. Mark Gibson is owner and CEO of D3 Technologies, a company that specializes in helping small to medium enterprises blend their people, processes, and technology. He and Steve had a great conversation about career choices for security professionals when deciding what sort of organization is the right fit for their skills and interests.
Let's look at the people side of things now for a moment, because one of the trends in the industry, you know, we've seen it for a while, it's not going to get any better, is skill shortage. And if you are starting out in the security space, there's probably something of an attraction in working for a small business where you can get your arms around the whole thing. But to the points that you've been making, there may not be the focus there. So 9 times out of 10, you're probably going to try and work for a larger enterprise that gives you a much broader scope where you can learn. But is that actually the case? I mean, talk to me a little bit about, you know, the attractions of security professionals in working in a smaller environment, because your own company is one of those, right? I mean, you're a small business yourself.
So it depends on really what your career goals are. If you are someone who is interested in just touching the technology and being the technician, we'll say, somebody who's working on it, there are going to be roles within small businesses where you can do that, but probably not just that. If you want to go to an enterprise, you might be able to be just an engineer or just a SOC analyst, someone who is working on just issues and then passing them along for analysis of business impact and things like that. If you are someone who, like myself, who kind of grew up a little bit in both the technical side and the business side, you don't necessarily want to be tied into just that narrow scope of looking at the issue or seeing an alert and evaluating it. You want to be able to have conversations with business owners and decision makers. And so within the small business arena, it's definitely not just the case with IT or information security. It's you can't specialize as much. You've got to be able to broaden your skill set. You've got to be able to engage with not technical folks all of the time in a way that helps them understand what the issues are. So if you're going to want to be in small business, you've got to be able to have a little bit more variety to both your communication skills and your technical skills. If it's something that you want to zero in on a specialty, that's when you're going to gear more towards enterprise.
And I think certainly in my experience, that variety, that overall scope that you do get of working in a smaller organization, where you do, to your point, have to understand the linkages very much more between business and technology and be able to express those and really join in. Those, for some, are very, very attractive propositions, you know, much, much more so than working in a large-scale environment.
Our next clip is from Steve's interview with Alexander Sager, head of the cybercrime division at the Council of Europe. At the time of this interview, in March 2022, the Budapest Convention on Cybercrime, which would mitigate law enforcement challenges of prosecuting across jurisdiction, was about to open up for signatures. Steve and Alexander discussed what this new treaty could mean for the future of cybersecurity.
And how do you think this is going to change the overall cybercrime landscape globally once this comes into effect?
I think we will have not only a change in the cybercrime landscape, there also, but in the landscape altogether when it comes to public-private cooperation
right. Between
law enforcement and private sector entities, and also relating to evidence that is not necessarily related to cybercrime. You know, a kidnapping case, a child abuse case, which is not necessarily online, but maybe in another forum, or terrorism threats, where you can cooperate much more effectively now. So I believe we will get away from the 0.01 prosecution
rate
to something much higher. We get more confidence in the fact that criminal justice authorities can actually make a difference and achieve results. And one important point I see also is that we may get a criminal justice response, a more effective criminal justice response, as opposed to a national security response to the problem of cybercrime, because we are a bit apprehensive that, like in the case for terrorism, that the response moves from the criminal justice sector with the protections that you have there to the national security side, where there is much less control over what security bodies are doing. The primary concern also for many private sector entities. Here you have something where something is in the criminal justice arena, it can be challenged and so forth. So I think it will be of benefit to everyone if we can get this more effective criminal justice response. And I think it will make a difference in terms of prosecution, investigations, adjudications, and so on.
That's excellent. And some would say, I think listening to this, you know, it's not before time, because one of the challenges that has always existed is how do we share better across nation states? How do we make sure that across businesses, across the private sector, we're able to, I think, probably have a lot more confidence is probably the right word in law enforcement, in law enforcement's ability to support. I think one of the criticisms has always been that private sector businesses are interested in prevention, whereas law enforcement perhaps traditionally has been more interested in actually catching the criminals and being able to be measured in that way. So it is a big shift, isn't it? It's a big change. A lot of people listening to this as well may be thinking, okay, well, that's great. They may also be thinking, well, I haven't heard about this. You know, how do I get involved? So if somebody is interested in understanding more about what we've just been talking about, what are the steps that they can take? What should they do?
They can contact me. Contact me or check also online for information. The question is, who and for what purpose?
Right.
For example, with criminal justice authorities, we cooperate every day from any corner of the world. I mean, we're currently working with Nauru in the South Pacific
right. On
improving the legislation, and we've been working with Sierra Leone in Africa and so on. So we work with law enforcement, criminal justice authorities all over the world, and strange enough, they do find us. Mm-hmm. So with them, we have no difficulties. We're also cooperating quite a lot, and we have participated also in those negotiations over the last few years with some major players, you know, with Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and so on. And they have been very much aware of what we are doing. They contributed, they provided written inputs, and so forth. Maybe some of the other providers, other type of private sector entities, with those, we would be very much interested in cooperating a bit more with fora like the one that you are involved in.
Right.
We can certainly do more industry associations and so forth. So we are now reflecting currently, we started to reflect how we can create a more frequent dialogue. Mm-hmm. Because what many private sector entities are telling us, and I had a discussion with them just 2 weeks ago with some of them, we would like to reach out on a more regular basis to key criminal justice experts. in different countries.
Right.
And have an exchange and tell them, this is right now our concern. And law enforcement also to tell private sector, this is our concern, you know, you're never responding. And then the private sector will say, okay, but maybe you're sending to the wrong address, you're using the wrong template, or you don't use the template at all, or we cannot verify that you're a genuine representative of a criminal justice authority and so on. So this is what we are now thinking of to do next with this protocol being open for signature. We have to look into the practicalities of implementing it. And this is one of the areas we are discussing right now.
Next, we bring you Mark Rawls, President and CEO of Invicti Security, a Texas-based company that provides dynamic web application security solutions. He and Steve talked about a subject many CISOs and cyber department heads deal with, how to convince your board to give you funds.
You mentioned another really interesting topic and subject which people talk to me a lot about, which is budget. You know, I don't have the money. How do I get the return on investment? How do I justify to my board? Any tips on that for people listening in?
That's a great question. And it's something that we hear quite a bit. And as a software provider, we are often in position of trying to help our internal champions and advocates, again, get the budget for our tool, which we believe to be very high ROI. And we're very proficient about making that point. But if we talk about, you know, headcount or really any kind of tool, I think a lot of the trends that we're seeing is that this is actually an area that boards are getting much more interested in, much more focused. And so while we need to keep helping our customers and we as an industry need to do a better job of speaking to the ROI, I think there's a trend that actually the boards are going to start helping us out. But let's set that aside for a moment. I think there's two basic approaches here that you can really take. And, you know, I think there's always a tendency to go for the first approach that I'll talk about, but I'm just not sure that it's the right one. And that's what we'd all call the FUD approach, right? Fear, uncertainty, yep. Doubt. And that's the, oh my gosh, there's this huge long tail risk. If we are breached, that could be hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, oh my gosh, think of the career limiting factors or show them testimony of the Equifax leadership in front of Congress, the SolarWinds leadership in front of Congress, FireEye leadership in front of Congress. Like, there is definitely a path there. And I think boards do understand that. And a lot of the focus of someone on a board of directors is around reducing that risk. And so I think there's a place for it. But I think anyone that makes that their first and primary cause, I think is kind of setting themselves up for a difficult day in, day out challenge. Because at the end of the day, it's a remote risk. And if you've read any kind of behavioral finance or behavioral economics, you know that the human brain weighs those risks, you know, does kind of a very poor job of weighing those risks,
right,
versus things that are much more proximate. And what we're starting to see is that when you have a fully staffed security team and you can identify security vulnerabilities, you can identify risk much earlier and faster within your overall development process, then you can also remediate those much faster and much easier. And I think this is an area that boards are actually, at the end of the day, much more open and amenable to. When you can show them things like, look, if we have a properly staffed security team, we can find vulnerabilities much faster. We can find them before they've been released. Ideally, we're finding them within days of when they're created. Well, then that allows that developer to remediate much faster. It reduces the number of developer hours required around security. It speeds our time to a secure release. And I think that's a language that boards also understand. And that's a very tangible near-term benefit that you see, as opposed to, hey, we're going to avoid this very scary but very unlikely scenario. It's, hey, every day that we do this, we get more efficient, we get more effective, and ultimately we're going to save cost. And as our organization continues to grow, we're going to require fewer developers because they're going to spend less of their time trying to track down and remediate a security vulnerability. Because like anyone, and I think everyone can relate to this, if you ask me to fix something that I did yesterday, obviously I can do that much faster than when you come back and ask me to fix something I did 2 months ago.
Right.
A lot can happen between then. And so it's not that one approach is right and one approach is wrong. It's that you need them both. And you've got to balance how much you speak to each one. And obviously, you can put big numbers up with the FUD approach. But if you can get to some numbers on the developer efficiency, the time to remediation, and you can show those benefits, that's a very tangible and very immediate feedback loop that I think most boards, most executive teams can really get behind.
Our next clip is from Steve's interview with Carl Allen, a private equity investor and co-founder of Prox Capital Group and the Dealmaker Wealth Society. Carl's bread and butter is mergers and acquisitions,
and he and Steve discussed how cybersecurity can be integrated into the M&A process.
Majority of our listeners are cybersecurity professionals. So let's talk about the implications of cyber for M&A. How much of a priority is cybersecurity to you and to the businesses you work with through that acquisition process? How do you go through trying to figure out whether or not cybersecurity is something that you need to be focusing on through the M&A process, something that is not perhaps relevant at the beginning, but could be when you come to, you know, closing? So what is the role of cyber, if you like, today in that whole M&A process?
Sure. So I think you split it into two parts. I think there's pre-closing issues and there's post-closing issues as well. So clearly when you're doing a deal, depending on how big or complex the deal is, ultimately you would go through a process of due diligence. And ultimately, as the buyer, you need to satisfy yourself that what you're buying is what you think it is. So there's a ton of legal, financial, taxation, and other documentation that you need to have. And what amazes me, what blows my mind even these days, is how much of that stuff is shared through apps like Dropbox and Google Drive. It's crazy. There are some very, very sophisticated platforms out there that you can utilize to build data rooms, which can have, you know, permission-based access and all those different things. Because what's really interesting about deals is a lot of business owners actually put off the decision to sell a business because they're paranoid about information going into the wrong hands. And right, if you're a small business owner and you go to a business broker and you have the broker list your business for sale, you know, out of every 100 people that look at it, 90 or so of those businesses, you know, they're not interested in buying your company. They just want to get access to all the confidential information, because then they can potentially hurt you in the marketplace. So for me, we're way behind as an industry, the M&A industry, especially at the small level, we're way behind where we need to be in terms of confidentiality and the security of information. It's a major, major problem. I think once you've done a deal as well, I think where a lot of businesses kind of mess up the integration is, you know, they're not actively looking at security. They've got all this really confidential information and it's just not accurately secured inside of their business. It really is a massive, massive problem. But, you know, for me, pre-deal, as an industry, we need to do an awful lot more with the confidentiality and the sensitivity information. It's an absolute killer.
It's interesting you say that, because if I think back to when I was doing deals, so that's before my ISF days, so I'm probably going back now about 12, 15 years, something like that. I would have said that was exactly the situation there. In fact, I can remember doing deals where people would say, whatever you do, do not involve the security guys or the tech guys or anything like that, because it's just going to slow things down. We'll figure it out once the deal is done. And what you're saying is that, you know, roll it forward now, say 15 years, and it hasn't changed that much when it comes to the confidentiality of, why is that?
I don't know. I think what I would say is a lot of the platforms that are out there, the specialized platforms, they're very, very, very expensive. And I don't know why. You know, they are sophisticated, but why they're so expensive to license. I think that's what's putting a lot of people off. You know, if you're Goldman Sachs or you're IBM, you're going to have these platforms because you can afford to buy them. But if you're a local business broker or you're an accountant or a solicitor that's helping to broker deals, buying that sort of platform can just be very, very cost prohibitive. And I think that's one of the major reasons why, you know, the advent of Dropbox or Google Drive and Microsoft's OneDrive, those for me in 99% of the deals that I look at, and some of them are $20, $30, $40 million deals, they're still utilizing these kind of free or very, very low cost resources. I think the platform industry needs to do a better job of having lower cost solutions, which still provide those levels of security. I think that's one of the major reasons why we've not seen mass adoption of them in the small and medium space.
Finally, we revisit our interview with Adam Rumenek, founder and CEO of Auxmode, a company that specializes in digital rights management, content strategy, and IP protection. In this clip, Steve and Adam consider measuring and managing risk when it comes to protecting IP.
So when we talk about managing that risk, What are some of the key things that organizations can do in that space? Because one of the things you mentioned right at the start was that organizations themselves, as so not studios, not people who produce this stuff for a living, but organizations that are producing perhaps their own film clips, audio clips, like I do with the podcast, for instance, they're also potentially at risk. So what are the sorts of measures, steps that people can take to protect the IP before they put it up?
That's a great question. Clips, best dubs, compilations. We believe that you can protect the whole episode. You don't have to upload the clip to protect the clip. If the entire episode is protected and you have a strategy by uploading the full episodes to these platforms on private, because maybe you have your own app for streaming, or if it's video, maybe you have your own video platform, or maybe everything's going through some podcast aggregate corporation. But as long as you have a strategy to upload your content on private to these other platforms and then protect it against the likelihood of misuse by third party uploading it, then you can actually block it worldwide. And then say for this podcast, for instance, you didn't have an audience in some country that you were looking for an audience that you obviously knew they were using YouTube or another platform, maybe release it in that area because they don't have access to this podcast streaming app that you created, or they just don't want to download it or something. So there are different business strategies that we like to bring to the table when dealing with corporations or organizations that they need to understand. You know, like the Joe Rogan show or something like that is massive on YouTube, yet Spotify bought it. They kept it on YouTube. They didn't get rid of it on YouTube. They just have multi-platform distribution now. And the reason is YouTube is so big. And we believe they're protecting it on YouTube and pushing people to, you know, Spotify because they did buy it. But the idea is to defend on all platforms to make sure that you control your assets or your IP from theft or misuse. As long as you have a strategy, you're going to mitigate the risk of theft. You know, it's the old 80-20 rule. We'll do everything we can to protect it. But there's a lot of platforms coming that, you know, we didn't see 3 months ago or 3 years ago. There's 81 different platforms as of spring 2021 that we track. That's a lot. There was like 20 2 years ago.
We hope you enjoyed listening back on some of our favorite interviews from this year. You can find the full episodes in our feed and linked in the show notes, where you can also find links to other ISF resources. Season 14 kicks off in just a couple weeks, when we begin a new series of interviews, starting with Sean Doyle, lead for the Center for Cybersecurity at the World Economic Forum. In the meantime, we want to introduce you to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in-depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. We'd love it if you'd help us grow our audience. Most podcasts are discovered through referral, when fans who love the show tell others about it. So please share the ISF podcast with other professionals like yourself so that we can reach new listeners. It makes a really big impact for us if you not only follow the podcast, but if you give us a 5-star rating. So thank you in advance for that. You can find us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.